person has already had the COVID infection, then they are all geared up. The T lymphocytes are ready to go, the B lymphocytes are ready to go, and they will strike and pounce while the cells have freshly taken up the vaccine and are producing it, and we must therefore expect a much more intense reaction, toxic reactions or cell destruction resulting from this encounter. So persons who have already had the COVID infection itself are at increased risk, very clearly, of suffering severe adverse events. At the same time, they can derive no possible benefit from the vaccination.
The COVID-19 crisis is a unique era in which economic explanations can help answer our questions related to unprecedented public health policy. Many of you may be asking if the COVID-19 vaccine was properly tested, or if it is safe for your child. The answers to such questions often lead to even more questions, and with the FDA's latest and very quick approval of Pfizer's COVID vaccine, the public is left wanting answers. And bringing together the science and medicine with economics can help us better understand public policy in the age of COVID-19. I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and now that Pfizer has received FDA approval on its COVID-19 vaccine, politicians, government officials, and the public health agencies are amping up pressure on citizens around the world to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. However, Pfizer has a rather questionable history, and still not much is known about the new mRNA technology. Joining me today to discuss and answer many of your questions surrounding the COVID-19 vaccines and the possibility of a vaccine passport program, today I am joined by Dr. Michael Palmer and Catherine Austin Fitz. Dr. Michael Palmer trained as a medical doctor with specialization in medical microbiology in Germany. He worked with Dr. Sucharit Bhakti from 1990 to 2000 and has done extensive research in the areas of medical microbiology and biochemistry. Dr. Palmer now works as an associate professor in biochemistry at the University of Waterloo. And our next guest, Catherine Austin Fitz, is the president of Solari Inc., publisher of the Solari Report, and managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services. Catherine served as managing director and member of the board of directors of the Wall Street investment bank Dillon Reed & Company. She also served as assistant secretary of housing and federal housing commissioner at the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development in the first Bush administration. Catherine has designed and closed more than $25 billion worth of transactions and investments to date, and has led portfolio and investment strategy for $300 billion worth of financial assets and liabilities. Catherine graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School, and studied Mandarin Chinese at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. She blogs for the Solari Report at solari.com. Dr. Michael Palmer, Catherine Austin Fitz, I want to thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Taylor. It's always a pleasure.
Of course. Dr. Michael Palmer, I will begin with you. Can you please explain for us in detail how the mRNA vaccine works on a cellular level?
Okay, sure. So the mRNA vaccine is composed of the mRNA itself. That is the molecule that we want to sneak into the cell so that the cell will start making, in this case, the spike protein. And in order to get it into the cell, we need a coating that is composed of various lipids. Lipids are fat-like molecules, and we have a specific mixture that contains several components, and each of these has a specific function in different stages of uptake into the cell. So altogether, what these bring about is the binding of the vaccine particles to the cell, the uptake into the cell, and once inside, the release of the mRNA from these particles that have been taken up into the fluid inside the cell itself. And then the mRNA can bind to ribosomes. These are the cell's little protein factories, and they will induce the synthesis by the cell of the spike protein. The spike protein, a macromolecule normally contained in the envelope of the coronaviruses, is then transported to the cell surface, right? So the spike protein pokes through the cell surface and becomes visible to antibodies and to B lymphocytes. These are specific immune cells which will end up producing more antibodies. And the exposed spike protein can also be released from the cell. This is mediated by so-called proteases, which we also find on the cell surface. So proteases are themselves proteins which cleave other proteins. And in this manner, a fragment of the spike protein can be released into the extracellular space. And it is then free to bind to other cells and can actually trigger some effects there. We will get into this later on, I suppose. Now, a sample of the spike protein that is made within the cell is also retained in the cell and chopped up into fragments. And these fragments are then taken again to the cell surface, but not alone, but rather in complex with specific carrier proteins, so-called HLA molecules. And this complex of spike protein fragments and HLA molecules is recognized by so-called T lymphocytes. And these T lymphocytes will then start attacking those cells that produce these fragments, which are being recognized as foreign, right? So this is a very broadly applicable, a very fundamental defense mechanism. The immune system sends the T lymphocytes on patrol, and the patrol just checks on every cell. Every cell is obliged to expose samples of all the proteins it makes. And if any of these protein fragments on the cell surface are recognized as not belonging to the body, the immune system will assume that this is probably a viral infection and will just get ready to attack and destroy those cells. That sounds like a very radical approach to weeding out virus infections, but it is a fundamental mechanism. The cytotoxic T lymphocytes or T killer cells that destroy those virus-infected cells are a crucial aspect of the immune response to any virus. So this is how it works, right? The mRNA vaccine more or less mimics a viral infection, and the immune system reacts accordingly.
And at this point, will the immune system be able to distinguish between the actual viral infection and the expression of the mRNA vaccine on the cells?
No, the immune system will treat those cells alike. It really cannot tell the difference between a cell that has been infected by the actual coronavirus or one that has taken up the mRNA vaccine and produces the spike protein. If anything, we must expect that the reaction of the immune system to the cells that have taken up the vaccine will be more intense and violent, because the mRNA has been optimized, the mRNA that we find in the vaccine has been optimized for very strong expression of the spike protein. So it is quite likely that the general inflammatory reaction, inflammatory activity triggered by the expression of the vaccine will be greater than in a typical infection with the coronavirus itself.
And what about an individual who has recovered from COVID-19 and may have antibodies? Could receiving this vaccine be beneficial, or could it put the person at an unnecessary risk?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, antibodies are the most commonly determined experimental parameter or diagnostic parameter for determining the immune status of a person. But that is mostly because antibodies are easily measured, right? It is much more straightforward to quantify antibodies in the blood plasma than to determine the activity of cellular immunity, but we have to assume that both are correlated. So a person that has antibodies most likely also has strong activity of T killer cells against those cells that express the spike protein. Now, in the context of immune responses, we must distinguish between a naive immune response, right? If the immune system has never before seen a certain pathogen, then it will take a couple of weeks until a strong immune reaction gets underway. That applies to both the B cells, the B lymphocytes, which make the antibodies, and to the T cells, which kill the virus-infected cells. Now, the duration of expression of the vaccine is limited, most likely to a couple of days, although that actually hasn't really been rigorously determined, or at least no such data are available to the public. But it is most likely that expression of the spike protein subsides after a couple of days. In the context of a naive immune response, that means the expression will no longer be very strong by the time the T lymphocytes and the B lymphocytes are out in force. So this will tend to limit the intensity of the immune response, of the aggression of the immune system against the cells that produce the spike protein. And it will therefore also tend to limit the intensity of inflammation. Now, if a person has already had the COVID infection, then they are all geared up. The T lymphocytes are ready to go, the B lymphocytes are ready to go, and they will strike and pounce while the cells have freshly taken up the vaccine and are producing it, and we must therefore expect a much more intense reaction, toxic reactions or cell destruction resulting from this encounter. So persons who have already had the COVID infection itself are at increased risk, very clearly, of suffering severe adverse events. At the same time, they can derive no possible benefit from the vaccination. That is a key point. The native COVID infection has, in the meantime, been proven to leave behind very strong, very robust immunity. Okay, so there has been no case essentially of people who have been diagnosed with a COVID infection. They simply don't get reinfected. There's no such cases are found basically. So that is a striking contrast to the vaccines, right? The vaccines, vaccinated people, as this becomes now really commonly known, right? Vaccinated people tend to get infected with the native COVID virus all the time. On the one hand, the natively infected persons are fully protected against reinfection. On the other hand, they are at increased risk of damage from the vaccines. So in a rational general climate, right, what would really be happening is that anybody before vaccination would be tested for existing immunity, but no such tests are offered. There is no option for anybody to present proof of existing natural immunity and thereby claim exemptions from vaccination. This is really unheard of. I mean, with any other infection, if you can prove, if you can detect existing immunity, you would never advise that person to get vaccinated. So this is a completely unreasonable policy to force the vaccination on everybody regardless of their pre-existing natural immunity.
So what we are doing right now is unheard of.
Absolutely. It is completely unreasonable. It makes no sense in actual medical science. There is no rational for it if you think about it in terms of real immunology as opposed to tabloid immunology.
In your expert opinion, is there any practical use for gene-based vaccines?
I don't see any practical use in the context of infectious diseases, right? We have a multitude of tried and true techniques for developing vaccines. We can use inactivated virus vaccines. Those tend to work very well with many viruses, tend to be perfectly sufficient. We can have live virus vaccines, which tend to be a little bit more risky. I mean, an example are the vaccines against poliomyelitis, right? The first vaccine was the Salk vaccine, inactivated virus. It was then, after some 10 years or so, superseded by a live vaccine, the Sabin vaccine. And then later on, after too many incidents had occurred with this live vaccine, the world switched back to the tried and true inactivated vaccine. Okay, so both of these approaches work and are better understood and are less risky than these gene-based vaccines. There might be, hypothetically, an application for gene-based vaccines in terms of tumor treatment, right? So if we want to draw the attention of the immune system to certain tumor antigens for the sake of treating tumors, it might be a reasonable approach, but it so far has no track record of success. I mean, the gene-based vaccines have been investigated for decades now, and there really isn't a track record of success in any field for them. So to use this completely experimental and unproven approach to develop a vaccine in record time against a virus against which no vaccine approach has succeeded so far, and then to roll out these experimental vaccines worldwide without proper testing, this is really the apex of lunacy. I just cannot state it any other way. There is absolutely no scientific rhyme or reason to this.
All right, Catherine, I will now turn to you. Forcing an unsafe and ineffective vaccine on the public does not make sense in terms of rational public health policy. It cannot be reconciled with the idea that governments act for the good of the people. Can you draw any parallels of what we are seeing right now to a similar time in history?
So, unfortunately, this is a rational public policy if you understand that public policy, both in the financial and healthcare area, in the last 20 plus years, Taylor, has been organized to promote central control. So we've watched a steady increase in inequality and economic inequality, and it's come from both central banking and government policies that are driving that intentionally. We see it in the financial area with the government flagrantly violating the laws since 1998, $21 trillion missing from the federal government, refusal to produce audited financial statements, now a decision to keep secret books. I call it a financial coup, but we also see at the same time in the healthcare area similar kinds of what I would describe as lawlessness. So in 1995, once the budget deal busted and you saw a group of people in the establishment decide, okay, democracy just doesn't work, and a series of policies were introduced that literally started to bring down life expectancy. Because if you cannot get the retirement savings on a financially responsible and sound basis, the only other thing you can do is to increase the retirement age or bring down life expectancy, which is what started to happen. In addition to the predatory lending, we saw the opioid epidemic. The OxyContin was approved literally the month after the budget deal failed. But the other thing we've seen, which has been very seriously documented, is government narcotics trafficking and government-supported narcotics trafficking, particularly in poor neighborhoods. And so we literally, from the 90s on, have seen significant government policies dramatically reducing the health and well-being of Americans. You don't begin to see it as severely in Europe, but again, you have this tremendous tension between the political pressure on the government to centralize political and economic control and what is in the best interests of the average person. And at this point, you know, I don't think there is any intention in the certainly in the U.S. federal government to protect the taxpayer and the citizen, far from it.
So in your opinion, this vaccine is not being used for the good of the people?
So it's not clear to me what the goal of the vaccine is. From everything I can tell, the number one goal here is financial. There is a tremendous need to, we're in the middle of re-engineering the global currency system, as well as the federal account. So I would describe this as a coup d'etat, not as a healthcare policy. And it is clear to institute the new financial transaction system, they need a passport system. And so, you know, but as Michael had sometimes said, as Dr. Palmer sometimes said, they could do that with saline solutions. So the question is, what else is in the vaccination? Since the budget deal passed, we've seen many different policies roll out of government that have caused people's toxicity to go up and their immune systems to be suppressed. I call it the great poisoning, and I've been talking about it for years. And if you look at what is going on with the injections, with the vaccinations, it looks to me like that is simply just continuing this process of dramatically increasing toxicity and suppressing immune systems. And for the life of me, I can't imagine what it has to do with improving health. Clearly, I think nothing.
Okay, well, now is a good time to discuss perhaps the only somewhat detailed Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine animal study that has been made available to the public, and that is a study which Pfizer submitted when applying for emergency use in Japan, in which the Japanese health authorities subsequently released to the public. Dr. Palmer, before we get into the results of this study and what it means, can you explain for us the technical approach that was used in this study?
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, the vaccine has several components, the mRNA itself and some auxiliary lipids that form this container, this shell around the mRNA, which protects it from premature destruction in the extracellular environment and facilitates the uptake into the cells. Now, in this study that was submitted in Japan, the most data refer to the distribution of the lipids, okay, of the lipid component. And the lipids, right, there are four different lipids here. The specific lipid that was labeled is cholesterol. It was radioactively labeled. If you use radio label, it is easy to trace the injected substance in with very high sensitivity. Very small amounts can be detected, and they can be detected with high accuracy. So in this manner, it was possible after intramuscular injection to follow where in the body the vaccine ended up subsequently. So that was the approach. And some data, very limited data, were also communicated regarding the whereabouts of the messenger RNA. To this end, Pfizer actually substituted the messenger RNA that is found in the regular vaccine and which encodes the coronavirus spike protein with a messenger RNA that encodes firefly luciferase. That is an interesting protein. That is the very protein of fireflies that permits them to glow in the dark. So you can detect the uptake of this messenger RNA and its expression in the form of the actual luciferase protein simply by measuring luminescence, light that emanates from the cells that produce this protein. Okay. And these data were really determined only for the injection site and the spleen and the liver. So all the rest, all the data pertaining to other organs in the body are based only on the distribution of the lipid, on the lipid shell. But it is quite likely that the lipids and the messenger RNA travel together, at least until they are taken up into specific cells in specific organs, at which point they will part ways. Okay, so we can take the lipid data as a proxy for the entire vaccine.
Now, looking at the results of this study, what are the main findings? And where in the body does this vaccine go? And why is this significant?
Okay, that's a good question. So the vaccine was injected into muscle tissue, and the expectation may have been that, as with other vaccines, most of the material stays in that tissue and the immune response to it manifests only locally. But what happened in this case was that the vaccine, at least a large share of it, entered the bloodstream, and it did so fairly rapidly. Even after 15 minutes, even 15 minutes after the injection, a significant amount of the vaccine was already detected in the bloodstream. That is quite surprising. The blood levels peaked after 2 hours, and then they slowly came down. And this was accompanied by the accumulation of the vaccine in other organs. The organs that accumulated the vaccine most rapidly and most strongly were the spleen and the liver. And that is not so surprising, because these organs are generally in charge of clearing the bloodstream of things that shouldn't be swimming around there. And to this end, they have macrophages, which is a specific cell type, which is very important in immune responses. Now, the liver, in addition to the macrophages, also has uptake mechanisms for so-called lipoproteins. Now, what are these? Lipoproteins are carrier particles used by the body itself, and these serve for transporting lipids, fat-like molecules, which, as you know, are not water-soluble, so they are encased into these specific carrier particles. Now, an interesting effect that can happen is that the so-called apolipoproteins, these are specific protein molecules found on the surface of the lipoprotein particles, can be released from these particles and can then instead bind to the vaccine particles. So now the vaccine particles, after having acquired this shell or corona of apolipoprotein molecules, look to the body cells just the same as regular lipoprotein particles. So these vaccine particles will end up in those organs that normally tend to take up lipoproteins. One of these organs is the liver. The liver, in fact, has a very central role in the synthesis and clearance and turnover of lipoproteins in general. But in addition, we also see accumulation of lipoproteins, uptake of lipoproteins into a number of glands, endocrine glands, which use cholesterol in particular, which is transported by lipoprotein particles, as a precursor for making their specific hormones. And that includes the adrenal glands, and we indeed see a strong accumulation of the vaccine also in the adrenal glands, the ovaries, and the testes to a lesser degree. So these were the only three glands that were really looked at in this study. But what also should have been looked at but wasn't is the placenta. The placenta also is involved in the synthesis of steroid hormones. It makes lots of progestin hormones, just like the ovaries do, in order to sustain its own health, its own activity. And another organ that takes up lipoproteins is the lactating breast gland, the breast gland in breastfeeding women. And indeed, right, this is not from the animal data, but this is from the adverse events reporting databases and also from experimental studies. We see some reports of breastfed children whose mothers had been vaccinated just a few days earlier. We see several case reports of newborns that were severely sick or even died after breastfeeding on the vaccinated mothers. And there is also at least one experimental study that detected the vaccine in the breast milk. Okay, so we know for sure that in humans, the vaccine is taken up into the breast milk, and the clinical manifestations in the breastfed newborn support that the amounts of the vaccine ending up there are indeed harmful. Okay, but we have to expect the same also with the placenta, even though it was not analyzed in this animal study. And we see it in the ovaries. And even in those organs, right, we have to take it to account also in any organ, essentially, right? Any organ is perfused with the bloodstream. We see the vaccine in the bloodstream, so we have to assume that the vaccine ends up in the so-called endothelial cells. This is the inner lining, the innermost cell layer of the bloodstream, of the blood vessels. And if the spike protein is expressed there, then we will have to expect an immune attack on those endothelial cells, and the resulting lesions to the blood vessels will trigger blood clotting. Okay, and we see also in the adverse events databases, we see lots of reports of blood clotting all over the place. We see stroke in the brain, we see heart attacks, we see infarctions and thrombosis all over the place in any other body part, essentially. So that reinforces the point that we have to expect at least that aspect of damage everywhere. Now, the important point here is that if you have medical training and you look at these animal data, you know that these risks exist. These risks had to be expected even based on these very incomplete and fragmentary studies submitted in Japan. Now, what the regulators should have done at that point is obviously at the very least demand that the missing pieces of this information be supplied. For example, data on the uptake of the messenger RNA in other places than the liver and the spleen, and also studies not just on cholesterol, which is a physiological lipid and may not imply so much damage as such, but the same kind of studies should have been carried out with the other lipid components, in particular the two synthetic lipid components, and among these the single most important one would be the cationic lipids, which play a crucial role in the release of the messenger RNA from the vaccine particles into the cells. These cationic lipids have a strong cytotoxic potential, right? You can imagine that if they are tailored in such a manner as to enter our cells, so they already breach the cell membrane as a barrier, and then inside the cell, they can cause cytotoxic effects on the cell by disrupting the function of the so-called mitochondria, right? The mitochondria are crucial for using oxygen and burning the substrates inside the cell, right? This code burning, this code fire, if you will, is going on there. If that is disrupted, then we can accumulate what is called reactive oxygen species. This causes oxidative stress. Oxidative stress can do all manner of bad things inside a cell. So we have a lipid, a compound, which has a very clear cytotoxic potential, and we would have absolutely needed clear information as to where this ends up in the body, how long it stays there, and so on. We only have very fragmentary information on that aspect. So the regulators everywhere, FDA, EMA, the Japanese regulators and whoever, they were remiss in not mandating that Pfizer supplies those data, okay? And this was done using a semantic trick, okay? If this vaccine had been declared to be drugs, right? I mean, there's this ongoing debate as to whether or not these are vaccines. You can make a case either way, I suppose. But the key point here is that whether or not it's a vaccine, it contains several new compounds. And now, based on the regulations which pertain to vaccines, it was argued by Pfizer that they don't have to supply those data. And this phony, specious argument was accepted. I mean, it's common sense that we should, before we roll out these compounds worldwide to the population, that we need toxicity information, regardless of what we call it, whether we call it a vaccine or we call it a drug, no matter what. These are new compounds, not so far approved for use in humans. So we obviously have to take them through a regular, thorough approval process, and we cannot fast track this simply by calling it a vaccine. Okay, so the that is one aspect in which the regulators were failing their duties to protect the public. There are other aspects why we have to call them out for having failed their duties, but this is already apparent from the toxicity studies as such. And to finish this off, right, so the clinical trials also should have been modified, the protocols for the clinical trials should have been modified in such a manner as to monitor for all these clinical risks of myocardial infarction and so on and so forth, that were apparent from the animal trials. This was not done. Pfizer was not made to monitor any of this. In fact, these clinical trials are really more or less a joke, but we maybe get into this a little bit later.
Yes, and we will touch on that and the clinical trials that took place before Pfizer was given the EUA. But first, I do want to talk about this study just a little bit more. Dr. Palmer, we know that Pfizer chose to use the luciferase enzyme and not the COVID-19 spike protein enzyme. How can this impact the validity of the study?
Yeah, that's a good point. The luciferase is more or less an inert enzyme, an inert protein. Other than producing light, it really doesn't do much damage. At least I'm not aware of any such report of cytotoxicity caused by luciferase. Now, that's different with the spike protein. The spike protein is such, right, you have to consider what the spike protein is good for. It enables the virus to bind to a target cell and to fuse with that cell. So it also has the function of breaching the cellular barrier. You can imagine that even on its own, the spike protein, even when it's not part of a virus particle, it can do some damage to cells. And it has indeed been observed. It has been substantiated. The spike protein is such as toxic activity. And if the spike protein, which can be released on its own into the circulation, binds to endothelial cells, it can cause damage to the blood vessels. And this can, for example, result in a breach of the so-called blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier is a specific provision in the capillaries in the brain, right? In the most other places in the body, the capillaries are more permeable, right? Small molecules at least can get back and forth across this barrier quite easily. But in the brain, we have a tighter capillary barrier. And this probably also contributes to a less effective uptake, to a fairly low degree of uptake of the vaccine into the brain, into the neuron, the central nervous system, brain and spinal cord. But it has been observed in experimental models that the spike protein is able to compromise the blood-brain barrier, and this could cause, in principle, a higher degree of uptake of vaccine into the central nervous system. And that tends to agree with observations of the damage to the central nervous system in adverse events, right? Not just limited to stroke, but we also have inflammatory type adverse events, for example, transverse myelitis. So you have a focus of inflammation in the spinal cord, which causes a transverse paralysis, right? So maybe your legs are gone, or if it's higher up, then your arms may be gone as well, immobile, paralyzed. And we have similar effects also in the brain itself, right? We see some reports of people with motor impairment. So they lose control of their arms and legs and start moving about uncontrollably or losing their steady gait and this kind of thing. So that might very well be related to the increased uptake of the vaccine caused by the expression of the spike protein rather than the luciferase. So in this regard, the animal studies were incomplete, and indeed Pfizer should have also been obliged to present actual data with the actual vaccine.
And I know that we did touch on this a little bit earlier, but I'm curious as to what your assessment is of the clinical trials that were carried out prior to Pfizer being granted this EUA.
Okay, so one thing that I already mentioned is that the surveillance of risks that became apparent in the preliminary animal trials was not carried out, right? So there was no proper surveillance of that. All test persons receiving the vaccine should have been monitored, for example, for the activation of blood clotting. There are lab parameters which can be easily tested using blood samples. None of this was done. The same goes for organ damage in the liver, for example. It is fairly easy to determine a couple of blood parameters that indicate damage to liver cells. None of this was done. So that's one point in this regard, right? With respect to monitoring risks of toxicity, specific risks of toxicity, these trials were grossly negligent. Now, another point, right? The efficacy that Pfizer claims for its vaccine was 95% in adults and 100% in junior persons, right, in adolescents. Now, these data are fraudulent. And these data were already apparent as fraudulent based only on the documentation that Pfizer supplied to the regulators. One aspect that makes them immediately suspicious is that the immunity, if we follow the graphs that Pfizer presented, the immunity apparently set in very suddenly on day 12 exactly, right? So there was no change, no effect of the vaccine on the incidence of cases between day zero after the injection and day 12 after the injection. And then all of a sudden, the graph just flattened, suggesting that all the vaccinated people became immune on day 12 exactly. This is not how it works, right? Immunity is always more gradual to develop, and there will be variation between individuals. Some will become immune sooner than others, also depending on the degree of previous cross immunity. And there are indeed some other numbers in the FDA report and in the EMA report that directly contradict the claimed degree of protection and the timing of that protection. So even based on these reports, even before any vaccinations were doled out in practice, it was already clear that Pfizer had been lying to the public and to the regulators. And the regulators should have caught it. They didn't catch it, or they were not allowed to catch it. Okay, so it is very suspicious what went on there. And you may be aware of recent data published by the Israeli Ministry of Health. Israel has been very thoroughly vaccinated, vaccination rates as high as 80% or so, and they used almost exclusively the Pfizer vaccine. And we see in recent data published by the Israeli Health Ministry absolutely no difference whatsoever in the likelihood of vaccinated and unvaccinated people to become infected with COVID, which means that the true efficacy of the Pfizer vaccine is not 95%, it is 0%. Okay? So the fraudulence of this claim, which was already apparent from the clinical trial data submitted by Pfizer themselves, has now been substantiated very thoroughly and convincingly in practice.
And this is not the first time Pfizer has been deceptive in its marketing practices. In 2009, Pfizer made headlines when it paid $2.3 billion in a criminal and civil lawsuit settlement. Catherine, can you please explain for us Pfizer's history with the U.S. Department of Justice?
So the Pfizer has a long history of being caught out on fraudulent marketing. I just sent someone an email about the Kefauver Committee in the Senate had hearings on fraudulent marketing by Pfizer, inspired by a whole series at that time. So this has been going on for a long time. Unfortunately, what has happened, as you see more centralization and more regulatory capture in Washington and in government, what has happened is the Department of Justice has taken the position, both with the banks and the pharmaceutical companies, that crime can be engaged in sort of a public-private partnership. So a pharmaceutical company engages in fraudulent marketing, they pay a $2.3 billion crime, and they proceed to go back out and do it again. And so we literally are watching crime enforced with a percentage of the profits shared with the government instead of crime being stopped. And so we've literally come to a point where the political and financial pressure on both the regulatory agencies, on the Congress, who's supposed to oversee those regulatory agencies, as well as the corporate media, is supposed to bring transparency to anything going wrong at those agencies. You know, we're watching a complete implosion of the sort of internal political and financial controls. And what that means is we're on our own. We cannot look to the CDC. We cannot look to the FDA. We cannot look to the Congress. We cannot look to the media. We cannot look to any of the organizations that are at this point literally, you know, prisoners of the what I would describe as the banking model to help us navigate, you know, sort of our healthcare. In other words, we can't depend on regulatory policy or public policy. We have to depend on our own due diligence. And unfortunately, we're now looking at a model where, as Dr. Palmer said, not only do the pharmaceutical companies have to not have to provide all the necessary toxicity and other studies to have whatever this is, vaccine or injection approved and permitted, but we are watching a model where they, as a matter of law in the United States and also elsewhere by contract, have complete indemnification. So we're watching a business model where it pays enormously to break the law. It pays enormously to engage in fraudulent marketing. They have no, if they can kill a million people and they have no legal risk within the United States. That's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary thing for a business. And when you look at the extent to which Congress is dependent on getting campaign contributions from stock market profits, generating corporate profits, you know, we're talking about a kickback machine in both Congress, the media, and in and literally in the Department of Justice. So the reality is, if you are a government official and you are working at the CDC or you are working at the FDA, you can't say no. You've reached the point where you don't have governmental sovereignty. The government doesn't have financial sovereignty, and it doesn't have the individuals working in it don't have sovereignty. And so increasingly we see the people who try to say no pushed out. And you'll regularly hear the refrain from government workers in Washington, if I do that, I'll lose my job. And unfortunately, we've reached a point where people keeping their job means going along with a criminal model. And, you know, I hate to say it, government has become, in this respect, a criminal enterprise.
Catherine, regulatory capture is obviously very dangerous. Can you outline the magnitude of the problem of adverse events that have occurred after the flawed approval process with these vaccines?
So we saw the FDA give a presentation in October 2020 with a long list of adverse events. And if you, in fact, if you go to the Doctors for COVID Ethics website under resources, you can link to a series of disclosure forms that are designed to help people enforce informed consent, including the family financial disclosure form. And it will walk you through many of the adverse events or the resources both at the federal government and at various websites, including the Doctors for COVID Ethics, that will give you a lot of disclosure on those. This is what is important to know, and that is my interest in these first began as an investment advisor when I continually saw families bankrupted by the adverse events. In other words, you can see in situations like this, adverse events cost a family as much as $1 to $5 million of not just loss of income or disability, but increased health care, even having to take care of a disabled person for the rest of their lives, which if it's a child, it's an it can be up to $5 million present value. So we're not just talking about having a cold or getting the flu or not being protected against COVID-19 and getting COVID-19. We're talking about something, Taylor, that can kill not just an individual, but do serious harm to a family, a neighborhood, a business. So these adverse events are very, very serious. And I think by calling them adverse events, we make it sound not anywhere near as terrifying and frightening as it really is. I would encourage anyone listening to this who hasn't had a chance to see videos or get detailed case studies of people who have been seriously disabled or even killed by this experience, I would seriously encourage you to see it, because these are truly frightening healthcare breakdowns.
All right, Dr. Palmer, I would now like to talk about the mechanisms of mRNA vaccine toxicity. So what are some of the mechanisms of toxicity with respect to the spike versus the lipids and how that relates to immunosuppression?
Okay, good. Now, we have already briefly touched on a couple of mechanisms of toxicity. So the spike protein itself, if released from the cell that produced it, can swim about the bloodstream and can bind to other cells and do some damage there. One effect it can have is the activation of blood platelets. So this can contribute to blood clotting, right? The blood platelets have a key role in the formation of blood clots. And if blood clotting is triggered, then we can end up with these thromboses, for example, cerebral venous thrombosis or stroke, heart attack, and so on and so forth. We have, and that is probably very important, the attack of the immune system against cells that produce spike proteins. I already mentioned the cytotoxic T cells or T killer cells, which will be certainly on the march, particularly after the second injection or also after the first injection in people who have already a degree of immunity against this virus before they get vaccinated. In addition, the antibodies produced by the B lymphocytes, which also recognize the spike protein, can activate other immune effector mechanisms, for example, the so-called complement system, that is a system of serum proteins that activate each other in turn in a cascading and amplifying fashion, and which will in the end bring about the destruction of the cell. Actually, the complement system shoots holes into the target cells, which will utterly destroy the target cell. So we have a strong, powerful immune reaction against the spike protein. Now, the immune attack against the spike-producing cells will eventually subside once the mRNA is degraded and the cells will no longer produce the spike protein. So things should actually then simmer down. And the spike protein-mediated adverse events tend to afflict only a minority of the people, right? So we see adverse events of varying gravity from death to transient effects in a number of vaccinees, but most vaccinated people will actually experience only transient symptoms. Now, the lipids, the cationic lipids, which I mentioned earlier, and which cause oxidative stress on any cell that happens to take them up, these must be considered a significant risk of their own. And the important point here is that this does not depend, right? The damage inflicted by these lipids does not depend on the collaboration of the immune system. So regardless of your immune status, you will take up those lipids, they will accumulate somewhere in your body, and you must expect some degree of cytotoxicity. What we know, the very, very limited amount of information we have from this aforementioned animal study, is that the cationic lipid used in the Pfizer vaccine is only very slowly degraded. And like other lipophilic, fat-like molecules, it can probably accumulate in fat droplets inside fat cells, but also inside gland cells, such as, for example, in the ovary, that maintain their own little storage of fat droplets for their own use. Okay, so we must expect the cytotoxicity of these cationic lipids to firstly affect everybody that gets the vaccine, and secondly to also have a protracted effect, right? So these compound is going to stay inside the body for weeks and possibly months, right? We have not seen any precise data, but from the limited information we have, we must expect that it will stay in the body for months indeed.
Recently, Pfizer and Moderna announced plans to administer booster shots or top-up vaccines. With repeated vaccination, is there a possibility for cumulative lipid toxicity, and what would that look like?
Well, yes, I would say there is a risk, particularly if these vaccines are administered every couple of months. And this seems to be now the narrative, right? So you get your first vaccine, you get a booster shot after 2 weeks, and then you might have to get a top-up vaccine with another slightly modified mRNA to chase the latest variant that has been announced and discovered, okay? And if we assume, which we must, that the lipids last in the body for a couple of months, then you will actually get a staircase effect. So each time you get another injection, the level of the toxin inside your body will rise higher and higher and higher. So we indeed have to expect cumulative toxicity.
Okay. And Catherine, there has been a discussion and also a push for more mRNA vaccines to replace our other traditional vaccines and even prevent certain types of cancers. Can you explain this to us and this specific business model?
So what happened to me in July, Taylor, is a business newsletter that I'm a subscriber to, which in my experience has a very good record of predicting what's going forward in business, particularly as it's impacted by regulations in Washington, had an entire page, which for them is remarkable, on the success of mRNA vaccinations for COVID-19 and the pipeline by the companies doing the vaccinations to roll out new applications of mRNA vaccines, including for cancer. And I did not realize when I read it, it was only after hearing Dr. Palmer describe the lipid toxicity that I connected the dots, and he connected the dots to tell me the lipid toxicity would be present for this entire pipeline. And if you look at how they described it, it made it sound like this was going to be a fantastic investment opportunity, investing in the companies making these mRNA vaccinations, because there was going to be such an extraordinary pipeline. And one of the things I found interesting as a layperson is what you're looking at is something that potentially not just increases your toxicity, but suppresses your immune system. And what struck me was that many of the diseases that they were talking about applying the mRNA vaccinations to were symptoms of a suppressed immune system. In other words, these were things in your body that blossom when your immune system comes down. And I thought, oh my God, this is a treadmill. A treadmill that brings us back to the issue of the vaccine passports. Because if the passport systems go into effect, then you're talking about a financial control system that can not only, you know, shut off your money, but force you to take injection after injection. It's very frightening.
Do you see in the future this vaccine passport program to also be tied to perhaps our income and is also somewhat related to this new push for central bank digital currencies?
Absolutely. So in August 22nd of 2019, the central bankers got together and voted on something called the Going Direct Reset. And that I would tell to you that everything that's happening here is part of the Going Direct Reset. The passports are part of a financial transaction system which will replace currency as we know it and give the central banks complete direct control of our bank accounts. So if they don't want you traveling more than 5 miles from your home, your money, your credit card won't work more than 5 miles from home. They can turn off your bank account. They can empty your bank account. So this is very, very scary. If you come to our website at Solaria.com, we have something called Cash Friday. And if you click on Cash Friday, you will get a 56-second video of the head of the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, which is the central bank for the central banks, describing with a great big smile how they will have complete control and can enforce all the policies and rules and regulations.
Part our analysis on CBDC, in particular for the use of general use, we tend to establish the equivalence with cash. And there is a huge difference there. For example, in cash, we don't know, for example, who's using a $100 bill today. We don't know who is using a 1,000 peso bill today. A key difference with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also, we will have the technology to enforce that. Those two issues are extremely important, and that makes a huge difference with respect to what cash is.
You're talking about a system with the passports that has nothing to do with healthcare. It has to do with complete financial control, which can then dictate to you your healthcare policies, among many other policies.
Dr. Palmer, you heard Catherine mention immunosuppression. Are we already seeing evidence of that with these vaccines?
Absolutely, we are. So in the very early days after the vaccination was rolled out, this occurred initially in the senior homes, right? With old and frail people who were given these vaccines. And there were reports from many countries all over Europe, but also Mexico, United States, that shortly after the vaccinations were given, the people receiving them died of COVID-related disease. So they had severe disease, which appeared to be COVID. Okay? The most likely explanation of that is that these people were already latently infected with the virus, but the infection was under control and would probably have petered out over time if left alone. But the vaccination shut down the immune system. And so this caused the latent infection to break out into the open, to become manifest and to really overwhelm the weakened immune system. We see also multiple reports of shingles. Now, shingles are caused by the same virus that gives you the chickenpox in childhood. Okay, so after you get through chickenpox, the virus never goes away. You remain latently infected with it, but your immune system keeps a lid on it all the time. At all times, each time the virus tries to reemerge, the immune system puts down the foot and just keeps it suppressed. So most people never will suffer shingles. If you do suffer shingles, it typically happens once you are past 40, 50, or even 60 years old, and you will find in the textbooks of medicine, whenever you encounter a case of shingles, perform some diagnostics, right? Look for some sort of underlying disease that suppresses your immune system. It can be a lymphoma, it can be leukemia, it can be nothing sometimes, but there is enough reason to suspect it so that you should go look for it. So it's a well-known effect of immunosuppression that an outbreak of shingles occurs. We see other case reports. I recently heard about a case that concerned another virus of the herpes group, the cytomegalovirus, right? Epstein-Barr virus is another one. These viruses also persist in our bodies after an initial infection and can be reactivated in situations of immunosuppression. So we see those cases. And a very concerning report, you can find videos taken by American pathologist Dr. Ryan Cole, who runs a large diagnostic lab in Idaho. He reports that he, in his materials that he had to look at, saw a definite increase in certain types of cancer already this shortly after vaccination. Now, cancer cells, particularly early cancers, are kept in check by the same cytotoxic T lymphocytes, T killer cells, that also keep viral infections in check. Okay, so we see both in the reemergence and the reactivation of viral infection and in the occurrence of new cases of cancer, we see a clear-cut immunosuppressive effect of the vaccine, and this after only one or two injections. So just imagine what might happen if we keep going, if we keep injecting the people over and over again with the flimsiest of reasons, just because somebody has sequenced a new variant and now all of America, all of the world needs to take another shot. Just imagine what this might do to our immune systems.
So, and let me just interject, Taylor, because this is really politics. You're talking about a process where the vaccine injury produces something that doesn't look like vaccine injury. It looks like something very different, and something very different, which is very profitable for the pharmaceutical companies and the medical industry. So we've literally got a process of weakening people that create huge and hideous profits for the the process that started it and can continue in theory for a long, long time because people may not associate the diseases they're getting with the injection.
Dr. Palmer, during the Doctors for COVID Ethics Symposium, you expressed concern over this vaccine's impact on fertility. There is also concern for vaccination in pregnant women. We know that autoantibodies against syncytin, which is a placental protein, are increased after vaccination. How could this harm a developing fetus?
Well, if we have autoantibodies against this protein, which plays a crucial role in the function of the placenta, then we must expect that the inflammation that results will harm the function of the placenta. Now, the placenta is the lifeline of the fetus. Everything that the fetus needs or needs to dispose of has to be transported across the placenta. And if the function of the placenta is compromised, then the growth and the development of the fetus will also be compromised. The barrier function might also be breached. For example, some toxic metabolites swimming about the bloodstream of the mother might show up in the fetal circulation at increased levels and therefore expose the fetus to increased levels of toxicity. But the syncytin autoimmune reaction, which is documented now, it was initially only hypothetical, but there are now some experimental data, as you mentioned, that support it, is only one aspect. We have to expect other types of autoimmune effects or other targets of autoimmune reactions might be involved. And we also must be mindful of lipid toxicity. The placenta, as mentioned earlier, will likely also accumulate the vaccine and the toxic lipids, and these might also impinge on the function of the placenta. Now, you may be aware that quite a few case reports of premature termination, right, abortion, miscarriage, are in the vaccine adverse events database. It will be difficult in each case, each individual case, to make the connection. That is essentially a problem for the statisticians. But with the currently very incomplete levels of reporting, we really have no good way of knowing the magnitude of this problem. It seems to be real, but the absolute magnitude is difficult to assess at this point. So this would be the problems that come from the placenta. We also already mentioned the problems with the ovaries, right? So placenta would affect existing pregnancies. Now, damage to the ovaries might render a woman infertile altogether, right? So she might simply no longer be able to conceive.
So Taylor, can I ask Dr. Palmer a question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so two of the great excuses in Washington, when you want to cover something up, the two favorites are it's really complicated or it was a giant accident. And these are used with great effect again and again and again. And that's why I just want to ask you this question. Is it possible that we can pretend that the people in the regulatory agencies in Washington around the world were so stupid that they didn't realize that this was the result? Were they clear that this was going to be the result?
Even before the vaccination started, this result had to be feared. The risk was real, right? And therefore, much more careful and thorough animal experiments should have been conducted first. And if those, which is very unlikely, had been successful, and indeed the vaccine had been permitted to go forward into clinical trials, those clinical trials would have had to be performed much more carefully and much more slowly. So only a very small number of volunteers should have been tested first, and these should have been very thoroughly examined for all manner of risks.
Right, but because we're under an experimental trial with an emergency authorization, when would there have been enough experience and data to know that this absolutely had to be stopped?
There have been enough data since the submission of the Japanese animal study and of the trial data. The animal study clearly presaged most of the risks which we see now manifest in the adverse events reports. Okay, so before any further clinical trials, even phase one clinical trials or phase two clinical trials would have been approved, much more thorough animal studies should have been carried out. And most likely, these would have stopped the project in its tracks. These would never have been successful. It is unimaginable to me that thorough, proper animal trials that clearly look at each of these risks apparent from the preliminary animal trials, it is unimaginable to me that these animal trials would have succeeded.
So whatever is happening, it's intentional. It's not incompetency, and it's not a giant accident.
Yes, that's my take on it. I cannot imagine that all of the experts in all of the regulatory bodies around the world are suddenly incapable of reading very basic medical data and making sense of them. It just doesn't work that way, right? These are experienced people, highly qualified people, highly paid people, and their job is ostensibly to keep the public safe. So whenever there is a potential risk that is not properly documented, for which no proper evidence exists as to its severity, it would be their job, it would be their duty to put on the brakes, to oblige the manufacturer who is seeking the approval to come up to provide these data. I mean, a normal approval process for a vaccine for a drug takes years. There's a reason for it, because there's always the back and forth involved. Each time such a red flag is raised, it's back to square one, and the manufacturer has to supply those data. They have to carry out the trials, and they have to resubmit, and it is re-examined. It is a constant back and forth. And because of this so-called telescoping, right, nowadays we can magically shorten the entire evaluation process from several years to just a few weeks. Obviously, this did not happen, and this was simply the trick they used to wave through all of these, to just neglect all of these concerns. If you look at the FDA and EMA documentation, you see the negligence in action. You just see how they pretend the problem doesn't exist and is not grave, and so therefore we don't need to require any kind of additional documentation. There are multiple examples. Just look at these 50, 60 pages long documents and you will see it. It is right there. The negligence is right there. It just hits you in the face. So this is clearly not an accident. It is clearly not an accident. It is clear to me that this is deliberate and that the FDA regulators and the EMA regulators were not permitted to do their job.
Maybe I could point this over to Catherine now. I mean, many people who are listening could be hearing this and they're wondering why. Why would this be happening? What's the motive?
So the motive, there could be multiple motives, but I think number one is they need to institute a new financial control system very, very quickly. And so it is essential to get the passports. But the other thing is, if you look at what they've been doing with the grape poisoning, it's been very effective for political control. A population, I don't know if you've ever seen a family struggle with vaccine injury, but that's a family that will not get out in March or organize politically. They don't have the time. So a weakened population is a population that can't fight. And also a population with a much lower life expectancy is one that will bring the retirement savings and the federal budgets back into balance. So, you know, this is a very ugly picture potentially, but what I would focus on if I was a family is, one, if you know you're on your own, then you know you have to protect your health. And that's what families have to do. The second thing they have to do is they have to understand that the, you know, that there is no government, and the lawlessness, according to the formal law, is very significant. And we have to stop the passports, because once the bankers can control your bank account directly and literally take tax money out or steal your assets, you know, then we're we're not only at the end of democracy, but we're in a kind of totalitarianism that the people in the West have never experienced before and understand. So it is imperative, once you understand what Dr. Palmer is saying, to understand you have to stop the passports. We have to have the option to not put into our bodies poison that we don't want in our bodies.
Now, there has been some confusion over the latest FDA approval with the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine, and I'm curious as to what both of you have to say about this. Dr. Michael Palmer, I'll begin with you.
So the approval is, in fact, has been granted to this Comirnaty stuff. But the problem is both extended the EUA, and under this extended EUA, they want to use up the existing vaccine supplies. And they also apparently want to continue evading the liability. And on the other hand, they have approved so that they can indeed advertise to the public that approval has been given. So that's the situation.
And so, Michael, I'm assuming that any vaccination, since the approved one doesn't exist, that any vaccination that occurs will be of the one under the EUA, so it will be an EUA injection.
That, for the time being, yes, that seems to be the case for the time being. They seem to be planning to use up, or they continue to use the EUA, so that they avoid the liability. And at the same time, the public is told that full approval has been given, and they have this artificial distinction between the two labels. They have two preparations, so they sell the same preparation essentially under two different names, and one carries the EUA and the other carries the official approval. Okay, so that's the scenario.
So can I also ask a question? The maker of the second one is deemed to be BioNTech, not Pfizer, correct?
That has always been the case. BioNTech has always been the contractor for Pfizer. I'm not sure whether it's even also a fully owned subsidiary. So they have been the contractor to produce this stuff.
Right, but the application that got approved just has their name, whereas the other has both of their names.
Yes, apparently so.
So I'm wondering if there's a different legal liability involved. The entity that's defending.
Yeah.
One entity is Pfizer and BioNTech, and the other is BioNTech.
BioNTech, yes. So as long as it's distributed through Pfizer, they are using the EUA, and that's apparent. I don't know. It's very confusing. So they have both EUA and official approval in parallel, and it's very difficult for you to know whether you are being injected under EUA or with the officially approved stuff. And Pfizer probably wants it both ways, right? So they want to have the EUA for liability exemption, and they want to have the official approval for encouraging people to, or encouraging authorities to mandate it all. It's essentially the same stuff, but it is packaged with two different labels, and one label continues to be distributed under EUA, and the other label, the new label, has the official approval. And that new label is not yet available, at least not in the United States, apparently. This label has been used in Europe already. But in the United States, this new label apparently is not yet available, and they have significant stocks of the other label, and that continues to be used for the time being under EUA. So if you get injected this week or the next couple of weeks or even months, you will be given the EUA stuff.
Michael, is it possible for you to explain the normal steps that happen for such an approval that haven't happened here?
Well, formally the applications have been submitted and the right agencies have approved them. Now what happens here is that for this particular approval, the process was cut short. It was just a 3-month period, and they completely skipped any review by the advisory committee, right? They said there was simply no data that pointed to any kind of concerns that would have warranted getting the advisory committee involved. Okay, so apparently they pretend the safety situation is so little reason for concern that they don't even have to experts. They just simply sign off. This is what happened. They are not involving the internal panel of experts in order to review any issues that have come up during clinical testing.
It was interesting when I read the letters that the signatories on the two letters had a name of Malarkey. Malarkey was one and Grubber was the other.
What's the other one?
Malarkey.
And the other one was?
Grubber. So, Grubber. And that's slang in America for BS and greed. A greedy, right? Malarkey and Grubber. I just find that to be a remarkable coincidence. I went to LinkedIn to see if they were real people because that's a remarkable coincidence.
Do you find them there? Did you find them on LinkedIn?
I found Malarkey on LinkedIn and I found Grubber someplace else.
But it still doesn't make them real in my book.
That's true. Given the names Malarkey and Grubber, I mean, I hate to say this is a very typical deep state thing to do.
Yes, I was just going to ask you that, Catherine. Yeah, isn't it normal for the intelligence community to kind of throw these hints in our faces as to their involvement in these procedures?
Absolutely. So I would love for a investigative reporter in the D.C. area to go ascertain whether Malarkey and Grubber are real people.
And also, I mean, have they signed off? Can these names be found on any other decisions issued by the FDA? Because, I mean...
Well, here's the question. Do they have the authority to sign off on this, including without the internal process? Because my guess is they're trying to engineer this. Typically, what they do in a situation like this is they engineer it through the political appointees or the people who are in certain kinds of bonus pools so that they can skip the civil service, because the civil service will give them a hard time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the legal aspects are. I only know that from a professional point of view, I mean, this is criminal. This is criminal negligence. I mean,
so in financial terms, if somebody did this with a financial deal, this would be called fraudulent inducement. You are creating the image of it being approved when in fact what you're getting is not, and you don't have the indemnification means it's all on you, and to not disclose any of that is a material omission, and the engineering of it as a sort of pre-intended artificial device, this is fraudulent inducement. Yes. So this would be, in a financial deal, you would have at least two criminal violations, in my opinion.
I would just like to say that the way this review process was conducted was criminally negligent, right? We have abundant evidence of grave harm. We have thousands of deaths in the United States alone. At the very least, we have a larger number of probably permanent disability, damage to the nervous system, stroke, myocardial infarctions, and whatnot. And all of these data are available to anybody in VAERS, right? You see an abundance of grievous harm, and then they pretend that the safety situation gives so little reason for concern that we can skip the expert review altogether. If this is not criminal negligence, then I don't know what is.
I spent many, many years on the road driving around America trying to understand how a country could say there were 70% Christians but be involved in so much, both financially and operationally, so much war and organized crime that was clearly a violation of international law or sort of certainly biblical values. And I studied and studied and studied. And one of the things I realized was that you could get a significant number of the population to go along as long as you gave them a story called the story of I am good. So you could give them a fake cover story of what was really going on. And as long as then their participation, they could feel, okay, well, I'm good because, you know, and they knew the story was fake, but they could pretend. And I'm starting to realize in the last week that this approval now gives a whole world of people the story of I am good, so they can go along with implementing something that's going to kill a lot of people.
And Catherine, before we do close out here, we will get to solutions. But first, Dr. Palmer, I do want to ask you a very basic question here. For those who have already received the vaccine, what is your best general recommendation moving forward as we see a new push for booster shots and top-up vaccines?
Oh, it's very simple. Stop now. I mean, I mentioned that the lipid toxicity will probably be somewhat long-lasting, but on the other hand, if you stop topping it up, if you stop adding to it, then slowly over time, it will be eliminated from your body. That is the most likely outcome. So it is just as with smoking. You cannot undo 10 years of smoking that you have behind yourself, but you can stop now and your health will improve. And the same is the likely outcome with these vaccines also. So just simply stop now. If you have survived the first couple of weeks after the vaccinations, then you are not likely to experience any acute effects such as stroke or myocardial infarction that will be behind you. And the lipid toxicity will slowly wash out over time.
Okay. And Catherine, you heard Dr. Michael Palmer say that those who have already been vaccinated, now they should stop. Those who haven't been vaccinated should perhaps not receive this vaccine. But you also have mentioned this other component to all of this, which is, of course, the financial, the economic motives, as well as the vaccine passports. So what can people do to prevent the eventual rollout of vaccine passports?
So one, I just wanted to emphasize again, the first thing that an individual or family needs to do is to stop their income being cut off because they refuse to comply with a mandate. So again, if you go to the Doctors for COVID Ethics website under the resource section, you can link to a series of different forms that will help you institute informed consent with an employer, with a school, or anybody who's requiring you to take these and can help protect you. Because the first thing we need is your income to not be shut off if you don't take this injection. So I would really encourage you to go access, it's a family financial disclosure form, a school form, and also an employer form, because a lot of the mandates are going to get pushed in this way. But then the second thing is you need to work with your state and local legislators and even your congressional representative. Do not permit vaccine passports to go into effect, because then we're talking about a new financial control system. And if you think these vaccinations are invasive, where do you see what they can do with your money and your assets? It's very frightening.
Catherine, how can we protect and save our future and the future of our children and potential grandchildren?
Well, I always say this is the end of a 10,000-year-old war, but one of my favorite quotes comes from a reporter I work with a lot. He says, hopelessness is an op and it's planet-wide. The first thing you have to do is you have to believe we can have a human future and we don't have to go along with this. And if you look all around the planet, the pushback, as you know, Taylor, because you've covered it, is extraordinary. People are just putting their foot down. So I'm in the Netherlands today, and if you look at the protests that have been going on in France, it's unbelievable. The French are not taking this lying down. So first, you need to know it's not hopeless. Second, you need to know that we can do something, but it's going to take all of us understanding that we're marching into a trap, and before the trap is thrown, we have to stand up and say no. And if each one of us will do that in our lives, in our communities, with our employers, in any way we can, you know, it will snowball.
Very well said. Catherine Austin Fitz, Dr. Michael Palmer, thank you both.
Thank you, Taylor. Always a pleasure.
Yes, thank you both too.
Of course. And I want to thank you all for watching this interview. If you would like to stay up to date with the latest science surrounding COVID-19 and the new mRNA vaccine technology, visit doctors4covidethics.org. And you can catch Catherine's work at Solari.com. Once again, I want to thank you all for watching this interview. Please share it on your social media and don't forget to subscribe to The Last American Vagabond. I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and I'll see you guys next time.